Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias! I see the shine out there in Vegas, sun shining on you, sweet life, doing well, living it up, doing it big, doing this for all the dogs today, huh?
Oh, brother, I am not doing this with you. Doing well from an undisclosed location in Las Vegas, not too far removed from a Lolo's chicken and waffles trip, so I am feeling good, maybe feeling sleepy by the end of the pod, we will see. But in a good mood, got to check out some fire basketball yesterday, so ready to dig into that. Before we do so, we'll get into some news items on the NBA front. Didn't get this on last show, so naturally I felt bad about it. But Joel Embiid opting to join Team USA for Olympic basketball in 2024. Not going to see him with France, not going to get to see the Embiid, Gobert, Wimby front court. Steve, were you surprised that this was the decision made by Mr. Embiid?
No. I mean, it's his decision. And honestly, I'm going to be honest with you. One, it means Team USA is coming. Two, when he said he wanted to honor his son who was born here and that he wanted him to know he played his first Olympics for him, who am I to say another word?
Yeah, that's just the answer. That's it. That's just it.
I don't think there's discourse on this one. He made his choice. Sorry.
Yeah, that's just kind of it. Can understand some of the frustration elsewhere, but if he's doing this for his kid, he's doing it for his kid. Also, Team USC is very good, and I think they could use someone with Embiid's size, just someone with his talent, period, but especially the size element. And if you add that to LeBron wants to play, and KD wants to play, and Steph wants to play, and insert NBA superstar here for this Olympic run, it's going to be kind of difficult to deal with Team USA. And so from, again, just joining talent, it makes sense for him. But ultimately, if he has reasons beyond that, specifically familial reasons, hands are up. That is a fair play. Enjoy yourself, Mr. Embiid. That's all I have on that front. While we're East adjacent, going to Boston, another guard move for them. They re-signed Peyton Pritchard to a 4-year, $30 million extension. Averaged a shade under 6 points per game in 13 minutes a game last year. Shot 36% from three overall. Played 20 or more minutes 8 times last season. Averaged 14 points. Shot 44% from three in those outings. Steve, with the recent moves with Boston in their guard room, what kind of role do you see Peyton Pritchard playing this season?
More significant one. I mean, I thought a big part of the move, especially of Malcolm Brogdon, was an endorsement of Peyton Pritchard. I think you could talk about some of the question marks when it comes to the playoffs, but it's been what, like 2 years of Peyton Pritchard plays, Peyton Pritchard produces. We don't have room to actually play Peyton Pritchard. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, we need you. And here he comes. You know what I mean? And so yeah. I understand clearing the runway because it was a logjam of sorts. You're going to lose somebody at some point. And so I think they decided to reinvest into Peyton Pritchard and you saw the benefit. I know it's a preseason game, but that man scored 26 points in 23 minutes. So clearly they're all in on some of the folks they had inside already. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how it works. The one thing with this team, I do think, one, he'll have a clear pathway. Two, he's going to help that second unit. Three, the Celtics are going to stagger folks. So he's going to add a punch. He'll have a more consistent role. And he'll have a Drew Holiday or a Derek White next to him to insulate him defensively to a degree. So I think it's one of those things where progress isn't always linear, but he's kind of earned this spot and he's going to continue to grow in Boston.
Got you. And just to briefly add to that, like, I like the point you made about him being flanked by one of Drew or Derek White almost at all times, I would imagine, depending on how they stagger it. Not like Peyton's a bad defender, but he is a smaller guard and teams tend to hunt those out. If you have someone like Drew or Derek White to help navigate some things, that's going to be helpful. And it also kind of fits into the overall ethos of Boston. And I think just in general, their search for more high volume 3-point shooters in their rotation. Peyton Pritchard certainly fits the bill there. He's someone that has proven he can play off of Jason Tatum whenever they're in the lineup together. And so I think it's going to be a pretty clean fit. We've already seen the way that he can produce when he gets those minutes. So makes sense that he gets this kind of endorsement. And now we can move to the W side. We got game one under the belt. The Las Vegas Aces taking a 1-0 series lead over the New York Liberty with a 99-82 victory. Really took off in the second half in particular. A 53-33 second half for the Aces. Before digging in any deeper with some of the numbers, Steve, what were some of your themes of this game one? What popped for you?
A lot popped, I think, to start out. And we're going to throw it right back to you because, again, you were in the building. I saw you putting on the Rock t-shirt and dapping up LeBron. We'll talk about it later.
Dapping up LeBron. Okay, go ahead.
Whoever has brought their defense to the table has won the game in these matchups. And after rewatching it, my mind went back to the first time the Aces and the Liberty played this season. And it felt like the Liberty were trying to figure out, okay, we're here. What is this? And the Aces were trying to send a message. Obviously, that evolved as they kept playing. Kind of felt like we got back there in game one. I felt like the Aces were locked in and looking to deliver a message. It's a very star-studded series. Two great teams. But like we talked about on the preview, it could be so simple. It could be as easy as Kelsey Plum plays better. Jackie Young plays better. And we're going to dive into this, but honestly, if the Aces are going to shoot 54.7% from the field with two-time MVP Asia Wilson, I have that right, right?
That is correct, yes.
As their fourth leading scorer with 19 points, yeah, Liberty in trouble. Like if Jackie Young and Kelsey Plum are going to score 52 points on 19 of 34 from the field, it's gonna be tough. It's gonna be tough. What was your main takeaway?
I think for me, like I kind of separated into the interior edge that the Liberty were walking into the series with what they can do with Jonquel and Breonna Stewart on both ends of the floor, and the perimeter edge that the Aces should have with their three-headed monster of Chelsea Gray, Kelsey Plum, Jackie Young. And it was very clear in game one that the perimeter edge won out in this one. You've already touched on what...
Are you playing DMX in the background? It's fine. It's fine. You got to roll through it, bud. God, you got to roll through it, man.
Oh, the dog is going to kill me. But anyway, it was very clear early on that Jackie Young was going to make herself a pressure point. And we talked about this a little bit in the lead up of the series. There's going to be Bonai Jelani on Chelsea Gray. Obviously, the Liberty are going to allocate a lot of resources to Asia Wilson. And so with that, Kelsey Plum, Jackie Young, we're going to have opportunities to really put their stamp on this one. And I think with Jackie Young getting the Sabrina matchup primarily, she established very early on, if you sag off of me or if you duck under a screen against me to try to keep me out of the paint, I will fire. I am comfortable flowing into this pull-up immediately. And she established that shot very early in the game. And by very early in the game, I mean within the first 2 minutes of the game, she established that shot as a threat. And I think just zooming, I guess just overall, Jackie really did a good job of blending in those pull-ups and those drives. Getting to the rim, getting to the free throw line. Also, again, not allowing the Liberty to get comfortable ducking under her to the point where Sabrina started going over. We got random hedges against her in pick and roll. And I was like, once I saw the hedge in the second half, I was like, oh, wait, this has turned. This has gone from we don't want Chelsea to get off. We don't want Asia to get off. We will hold serve as much as we can against these other two too. We can't let Jackie Young keep doing this. And the fact that that led to a Chelsea Gray three just felt kind of poetic in that regard. But it has to start with the guard play and how handily the Aces won that matchup.
Well, to bounce off what you said about Jackie setting the tone, Jackie Young and Kelsey Plum's first threes sent a massive message. I think Jackie got her first one. It was a handoff. Sabrina was right there, giving her space to try and protect the drive, went right into a pull-up, no hesitation, and then just didn't stop the rest of the game. I think for Kelsey, the Aces had some off-ball movement. The Liberty were there the whole possession. Sabrina switched on to Asia. Jonquel kicked her out. Everything was fine, and then Kelsey Plum just hit a three in Courtney Vandersloot's face. Now, one thing you touched on, which is the key for me, the blend. It's the blend. They cannot give up Kelsey and Jackie making those type of shots while also being able to drive and create. And that's where the pressure is going to lie, because this isn't the first time that Jackie's played well against the Liberty. She played well, I think, the last time they played, 94-85, Liberty won. She was 9 for 15, scored 24. The difference was Chelsea Gray was 3 for 13 that game. Kelsey Plum was 4 for 14 that game. So it's for the Liberty, it's we need one of you to not do this tonight. We've got to work to get one of you to not do it. And that's where the Aces didn't really cooperate. I thought the Aces did a great job offensively of blending quick decisions, ball movement, player movement, drive and kick. They did have possessions where it stagnated. And when you watch it again, the Liberty's defense, I'm sure they probably feel better about it than they did leaving the arena.
Yeah.
But when you have the good defensive possessions, and this is one of the things that stood out to me, it felt like some of the best possessions from the Liberty ended up with the Aces making shots where it didn't matter. And that's deflating over and over and over again. And now you mix in Kelsey Plum driving. Now you mix in, oh, Asia's got it going. They have to take one piece off the table, or they have to take one thing off the table, because I think they would live with some of these pull-ups if they were able to contain penetration.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're giving up the shot making because of the talent, you're giving up the drives and having to help and be in rotation, they're driving and kicking and hitting threes, that can be a very difficult thing to deal with. And so if I'm the Liberty, we got to turn that volume down.
Yep. And just quickly on that point, the Aces outscored the Liberty by 10 in the paint, and then also shot, 9% better from three? The Aces were 9 of 22. The Liberty were 9 of 29 in that one. And remove some of the shots from Marine Yohannes, that feels worse. What, actually, briefly, before we even get into deeper, like, actual analysis, what the heck did we see from Marine?
No. Je ne sais pas, mon ami. Vraiment, je ne sais pas. C'est difficile. C'est très difficile. Je ne sais pas. What on earth?
What was any of that? In the first half in particular, what was that? We got just a one-legged pull-up three against drop in the flow on purpose.
The funny part is she hit the leaning shots on all of those, just regular, like staggered, got it, pull-up, got it, and then just one-legged casual.
Yeah.
Casual. Like, we got the Patrick Ewing answer in the WNBA finals.
You work on that shot? Yes. Yes, she does. She's been doing that for a long time. I was making this joke a little bit earlier today with a friend of mine. I was like, you know, it's fun kind of being on the W side and the NBA side. Cause like, I remember all the chatter a few years ago, like, oh my goodness, James Harden's adding a one-legged three to his bag now. This is going to be cool. And like, Marine just has it. Like, this is just literally part of her shot diet that she just sprinkles in. And it was like a whole spectacle when James was doing this during like shoot around of a game. And I'm just like, yo, this is some of the wildest stuff. And very briefly, since I was in the arena, one, the crowd was electric. And it was a true sellout in that game. Not the sellout, but most of the arena is filled, but all the tickets are bought. So you still see empty seats. Like, before the game started, the seats were full. So I knew off rip, this is going to be a very special atmosphere. And it was. And to circle it back to Marine, if you could have heard the crowd live when that shot went in, if you could have saw media row, like someone literally just stood up and just walked away from their seat when they saw the shot. Just like, buddy, if I wasn't sitting where I was sitting, I would have done the same thing. Like, I was in awe of what I witnessed live there. It was insane.
Okay. Number one, don't be surprised. Vegas is an amazing basketball town. I keep telling you this. Salute to you, Las Vegas. Number two, I'm going to ask a free throw real quick before we get back to business.
Okay.
Better reaction to Marine's shot, Kelsey Plum or LeBron James?
Oh, Lord. Can the answer just be?
Kelsey was fed up.
Yeah. And I would imagine so. Kelsey was probably the funnier reaction. Cause like everybody in the arena had to feel her in that moment. That is, you are playing 2K and it's like, how the heck did you green that?
Also, how funny was it that Coach Hammond called that timeout quickly as soon as Marine started to get loose?
Oh no, she got a three, she got a layup, and it was like, nope. Time, like the Aces still had the lead when they called that timeout. She's like, nope, 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 nope. I can imagine like the commissioner's cup just flashed in her eyes, like, we are not letting her do this again. Career high postseason, 14 points for Marina Yohannes. She had 8 points in the first quarter, and that tied the total that she had in the entire postseason. Mm-hmm. Up until that point. So she very, when we say instant offense, that just the literal embodiment of instant offense for Marine. But moving back to the analysis, I guess I'll toss this to you. How did you feel about the Aces defense in this one?
It was good. I think the one thing that stood out to me, especially early on, one, I thought the Aces were locked in. I was a little surprised at the amount of notes they tried to hit, especially early in the game. So they showed switching. Key Stokes, go ahead and switch out on Sabrina. That's fine. When they switched and they had a mismatch in the post and Jonquil had it, even Stewie, double. Okay. I did like that. Okay. We showed a switch. Sabrina took a pull-up three, I believe, and she made it. And the next time down, they trapped Sabrina. And I was like, ah, you guys are moving pieces. You guys are not giving one steady diet. So I liked that part. I liked the activity they had. I thought they did a good job of pressuring the ball. They did a good job of denying, throwing off timing. It just felt solid as the game wore on. It didn't feel like they had one specific hole, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then we saw Asia starting to have blocks. I thought the transition defense was pretty good. It felt more active in the second half live than it did on the rewatch.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily like a bad thing, but I think they did what they were supposed to do. And it's the kind of success we've seen them have in the regular season against the Liberty, where we can disrupt you. We're not letting you run your stuff. You can't drive. I think that's the other part. They worked to take away the drive from the Liberty guards. Mm-hmm. How comfortable did the Liberty guards look making drives? Even when they were small and Stewie gets a catch on the perimeter, at least Clark's right there. If Courtney Vandersloot is spaced, it's Kelsey Plum, whoever it is, they are helping off. So even if you want to put your head down, Sabrina, there are people in the way. Asia Wilson, protect the paint. So I just think it felt like we're doing our job.
I got you. Like the doing your job mantra was something that Asia talked about postgame. And which someone asked, like, hey, what was the second half adjustment here? Considering, again, they won the second half by 20. And Asia was flat out, like, we just did it. We just defended. Like, we didn't come up with any kind of fancy scheme or anything. Like, we literally just did our jobs. And that kind of popped on film. Like, one thing that caught my eye very early on in this one were the Jonquil post-ups. Honestly, just the post-ups in general. Because outside of the switches and then the Aces trying to navigate that, if Jonquil had against Kia Stokes, it was just like, Kia, do your best. Asia against Stewie, do your best. And it didn't feel like they were sending as much help as we saw in some of the earlier matchups between the two. And I was like, I wonder how much that's going to hold. One, because that could just be physically taxing, especially with the Jonquil post-ups. But two, with Jonquil having the early success, I think she had 12 points, 9 boards in the first half. I kept waiting on it to become, okay, we have to send a double to Jonquil. And maybe that would have been what really opened up New York's offense, which didn't feel bad, to be clear. But like, I wonder if that was going to be Jonquil becomes even more of a pressure point. Now they're able to play out of that, ball pops more, they get easier threes. And maybe that's how they find some of the 3-point shooting that they didn't have outside of Marine in the first half. But like, that part never really came, in my opinion. Go ahead.
Well, I think they just stayed committed to their plan, especially since they were doubling if there were other mismatches. Mm-hmm. I think staying at home and making you finish over you is one thing. The other part of it is, especially since it was a back and forth game to a degree, if you're just posting up, we can stay at home. We don't have to deal with a lot of your movement. We don't have to deal with anything else. We can stay at home. Good luck. That's 2 points. I think that's a lot easier to do when your offense is flowing or you're leading. But I do think if this was a scenario where the Liberty were up 8 and now they can go to the Jonquil post-ups or the Stewie post-ups, does what you're saying happen?
Yeah.
to where now this is more impactful because you guys can play a little bit of prevent. But I can understand if the gambit is, hey, we believe in our bigs and we're just going to stay at home. And if you want to keep tapping this button, that helps our defense to a degree. Mm-hmm. But that is a thin line.
Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. But yeah, that was something that kind of caught my eye early. But then the second half, like, again, it really just felt like, again, ball pressure was there, but maybe it was a little bit earlier or pressing up a little bit higher. I will say, just overarching theme for this one, as we talked about the Liberty guards a bit, they did not want Sabrina to shoot. Point blank, period. That's something that Becky Hammon has talked about basically before or after every Aces matchup with the Liberty this season, whether they won or lost. Every time she's asked about some of the Sabrina big three-point shooting games, it's like, well, she wasn't even supposed to get threes up, much less hit them. We didn't execute what our game plan was supposed to be. And I think that kind of played out with some of the traps. Like, the first pull-up I think Sabrina hit was over the outstretched arms of Kia Stokes. And I put it in my thread. I was like, man, Kia got up. It's not a new thing for her to work up to the level against the Sabrina pick and rolls. But she worked up earlier than usual to make sure, nah, you're not getting a clean pocket here. Sabrina, a tremendous shot maker, so she made it anyway. I was like, it's subtle, but yeah, they're really keyed in on Sabrina. And then you mix in the traps. And it's like, nah, they did not want her to shake loose. So I think back to, what was it, the 31-point game. She went 6-10 from three. Sabrina took 5 threes total in game one, which, you know, still you zoom out, like 5 isn't a low number. But considering who Sabrina has been all year and what she's been to the Aces in these matchups, after the first one in particular, that felt huge. That felt like that might have just been the biggest part of their game plan success in game one, honestly.
You know, it's interesting. One, I want to see how the Liberty adjust, because the Aces did show their hand to a degree. Not that it's anything they haven't done during the season, but they did show, okay, this is what we're going to do. So do we see more? Do we see higher screens for Sabrina? Because if we go back to that Sun series, that was one of the Liberty's counters. Cool. There's no room here. We'll just set this higher, let her get downhill. I did feel like she was conscious of it and got off the ball quick. Mm-hmm. If that made sense. She didn't force the issue a lot. So, I mean, if you're going to hedge or trap me, okay, one dribble, I'm out. But now you need someone else to create the momentum. And the only other person that got that activity from the guard room was Marine. And that was after making all of the shots.
Yeah.
And this is one of those series where Courtney Vandersloot's going to be important, because for her to be maximized offensively, she's got to be able to get downhill for some help, et cetera, et cetera. The Aces going under everything. The Aces handling the rescreen when you go under, which is the counter. The Aces giving up that shot. And now it becomes short closeout. If it's a kick to her, it's either going up or it's another swing. So how can they generate some of that movement? Because how many of Sabrina's attempts came from someone else driving and forcing rotations?
Didn't feel like a ton.
So that's where it's like, okay, how many buttons do you hit? Do we go to Benaja Landy posting up and try and get a stagger away? Do we go with higher pick and roll? Like, I feel like there's more things they can do. I don't know if it's going to be a straight pick and roll series.
Yeah, I don't know if it can be. And like on the Vandersloot portion, I guess I left the game live and then also the rewatch kind of wondering, like, we talk about it kind of often, like, is this a press to do better button or does something need to shift? I guess my question is, like, how much can shift with Sloot in particular with the way that she's being defended?
She's got to be aggressive. She's going to have to be aggressive. They're helping off. You either got to cut, become a screener. If you get the catch, you got to drive, finish, or knock down some shots. But she's going to have to be aggressive with the mindset to impact the game somehow. The last thing that can happen for Sloot and Liberty, she stops shooting. She stops looking at the rim. Now they win twice, basically.
Yeah. You don't get the extra advantage. You don't get the advantage creation, and ultimately she continues to be a help point when she doesn't have the ball in her hands.
But, I mean, I think transition may benefit her. If they get stops and she's able to run and make some plays, or she's able to get a couple layups, that may juice things up for her. But yeah, I think the biggest thing is stay aggressive. Stay aggressive.
Got to. Was it all bad for Sloot? Like, did make some pretty nice passes in that one. There was one to Marine that she curled off after a flare. The tight window bounce pass to Breonna Stewart to get a layup after setting a guard screen and kind of popping up there. So she was able to leave a fingerprint or two on the game, but it wasn't the full hand from Courtney Vandersloot. And I do think the Liberty are going to need that in game two and moving forward in this series. We talked about it in the lead up to this one, wondering how big of an effect the benches would have. I think you asked the bench rotation question, and both teams essentially settling on six players in this one. Like, there was, I think, 8 minutes for Kayla Thornton. We got to see some Jocelyn Willoughby at the end of the first quarter, which is interesting to me. Another big wing you could toss on Chelsea Gray to add to.
Man, playing basketball is so hard. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but just imagine, hey, can you go defend Chelsea Gray for this one possession? I know it's been a minute. It's the finals. Don't worry about it. Thank you.
You're like, huh?
Nah, you got bet. I got you.
Like, you want to earn your opportunity, but also.
Hey, I'm telling you. It's a whole different window to it. But continue. Sorry. Your bench point.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, it was interesting to me. Like, less so on the Aces side, because I figured, I think I said like 6.5 on the pod. To where they would land, like Alicia Clark was firmly in, and there'll be a stint from someone. But it just turned into, nah, this is just the six. We saw it was also just kind of fun, or I guess more so interesting, watching the Aces toggle through different variations with this six player rotation, to where we saw some Alicia Clark at the three with Asia and Kia Stokes out there. We naturally saw Alicia Clark at the four alongside Asia. We also saw Alicia Clark at the four alongside Kia Stokes when Asia got a break. As rare as that was in that one, it's I want to see how much that holds, because I think the Aces are qualified to do it. Like, they've been playing six or seven in their rotation for most of the year, to the chagrin of a lot of folks. But hard to argue with 34-6. But now, you know, they have the big break leading into the finals. It's 2 days in between game one and game two. It does seem more feasible than you would expect for them to roll with just six if they want to do that. Do you have any concerns with that at all?
I mean, I understand it. It's go time. This is it. It's win or go home for the championship. So I get leaning all the way into it. If the Liberty hit some of these buttons and play better defense, and you now have to grind some more possessions, or offensively that ball's moving and you got to rotate at this level over and over again, that could wear you down eventually. Mm-hmm. My bigger concern is less that, because I think they work too hard. They're too determined. Foul trouble. Mm-hmm. Are you prepared for foul trouble if you've gone all in? And they didn't necessarily hit the button all the way, but if that were to happen and now you have to pivot back, what does that do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt like we were getting close to getting that question somewhat answered, either positively or negatively. Kelsey Plum picked up two quick fouls. And also, just, you can see it, I'm sure it was apparent on the broadcast too, neither team was happy with the refereeing in the game. Going to the early second quarter, both teams getting hit with a defensive 3 seconds call within like a minute of each other. And the general confusion from both sides when it happened. I was like, oh yeah, they calling stuff. This is gonna be fun. I'm still cackling at Becky's reaction to the uncalled travel on Sabrina on that corner three while the Aces were up, but she threw some like, oh boy, that's not great. But that part was fun. But yeah, I guess interesting to monitor the potential foul trouble for the Aces. Like, my mind goes to like, okay, what happens if Kia gets a foul trouble? What happens if Asia gets a foul trouble? But like, the guard room really seems more prevalent in this case.
No, I'm with you. It's the guard room for me. It's Asia or the guards. That's no disrespect. I feel there's enough of the rotating of lineups, as you spoke of, that we can figure that out. If one of those two gets hit in a different way, what's that look like?
It gets kind of tough. And that brings me to, first, a general question for you. Less about the actual game or the ball score. How did you feel about Stewie's usage in game one?
I felt fine with it.
Okay.
I mean, she got a whole bunch of shots up, and most of them felt clean. I actually thought one of the questions I was going to ask you is it funny? This might have felt like the best we've seen Stewie and Asia play.
Yeah.
In these matchups this year.
Sure is. And it was Stewie, I think, shooting 40-something% from the field, 21 points. And Asia only had, as you mentioned up top, fourth leading scorer on the team.
So, I mean, with Stewie, I feel like it's always they can do so much. Which thing are they going to hone in on? I feel like there was opportunities when the Aces were smaller to maybe get Stewie a closer catch and let her be more of a pressure point there. But she can come off screens. They did a good job, I think, of adjusting to have her set more screens off the ball to try and open things up that way. So for me, it's never a concern with how are they going to use Stewie, because there's so many ways you can do it. It's can you get clean shots and are you going to generate different things from it? I think they probably could have tapped the let's post Stewie, get a double play out of it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I understand them kind of trying to move things around.
That was going to be the one note that I had, because ultimately I mostly felt fine with the Stewie usage. And this is something that I've asked you about before, especially as it pertains to like the rim pressure with Stewie. But like I was mostly fine with what happened. I will say, like, as the Aces, especially early on, when some of the foul stuff was happening, it felt like the Liberty were saying, okay, let's get Kelsey in action. Let's get Sloot to set a screen, either on ball or off ball. Let's get Kelsey in it. Let's see what we can do here. They pressed that button briefly and then they stopped pressing it. And I was like, well, I know you don't want to use your flow, but this also feels like an opportunity to really generate some stuff, establish Stewie even more as a pressure point, and also have the benefit of maybe drawing that third foul on Kelsey, if you can, and really forcing the Aces into that bench. But other than that, like, I didn't feel bad about it. I will say, while we're on post-ups, I think Benai Jelani's first post-touch came like midway through the third quarter. Which, again, like, you don't want to continue to tap the, hey, let's just post up Chelsea Gray, because she's one of the best guard post defenders in the league. But also, like, the general theme of this postseason, something that you've hit on expertly throughout this postseason run, is like, when Benai Jelani hits, the Liberty go to a different level. And it did feel like a pretty quiet run for Benai Jelani for most of this game. She got some shots in the third quarter. Do you feel like the Liberty need to shift any more uses to Benai Jelani? Or is that just that was just the nature of the flow of the game in game one?
No, I mean, I think they can. I think they can definitely throw it to her some more in the post. I think they need her drives, especially in this series. They need her to be aggressive. And then now she's forcing help. You see who it's getting a kick to. It sounds like it's do better for the Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
They got to keep their movement up. They got to hit the pressure points. They got to keep forcing the Aces to rotate and guard. They got to make quick decisions. They've been here before. I mean, like, this isn't supposed to be Bale, but like, remember, they were up, what, 8 in the second quarter?
Mm-hmm.
They were up 5, and then everyone missed a 3 as Jonquel tried to get every offensive rebound in the world.
Oh my goodness, that sequence midway through the season. And it was so like a bunch of misses, offensive rebounds, ball goes out of bounds, Aces call timeout, and then it was another missed 3. And I was like, okay, man, y'all just aren't going to be able to get this done, huh? That's tough.
And then you look up, it's 35-35. Like, I feel like there's like 4 different times it was like Aces, 7-0 run over the last 250. And I was like, okay. Like, I think the Liberty were down 59-60, and Stewie had a wide open lane, wide open layup. Benaja just missed her, and it's a turnover, and it's like, okay. And the other part is, like, this is low-key the Liberty in game ones. It took a little bit to separate from the Mystics. Eventually, they got there, but it took a little bit. They lost to the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost this one. So I'd expect more purpose and more execution in game two. The difference here is you are dealing with the Aces. You are dealing with the champs. And not only do they have a star forward you have to deal with, they have guards who can beat you and are looking to beat you and looking to attack. And that's where the Liberty got to set the challenge. They got to defend better. You got to keep the ball in front. Number 20 is going to have to buckle up.
20 and 22. Yeah.
She worked, but they hunted over and over and over again. Go back. Watch the possession. There's one where she switches twice, and they drove each time. So, and actually, this is one thing I want to point out. The Aces. The Aces did a very good job with their cutting. Because there were times where even Stewie would switch on to Chelsea Gray. I think it was Jackie Young cut from the wing, cleared that space, and now Chelsea drives right. They didn't let the Liberty load up their help as they had in the regular season. That wasn't a perfect world for the Aces. They did have some of those possessions where it's like, okay, there is a hitch here. The ball is not moving. Oh, you didn't get the ball in the paint. And now it's okay. Those shots feel a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you made some, but also, do you want to live on that shot diet?
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know which team feels better. Aces did make 35 field goals. They had 21 assists. Liberty made 32. They only had 17. So who's going to generate shots consistently? I have a question for you real quick.
Okay.
I know we've gone deep on this. The Liberty trotted out zone a couple times. I personally don't think that's going to be the answer. I can understand maybe trying it out of a timeout to try and get him out of rhythm. There was a moment in the first quarter. I couldn't tell if the Liberty were in zone, if not, but it was just Stewie at the top, so I assumed they were.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else was kind of matched up, though. The Aces were small. Stewie was on Jackie Young. And I wonder if that's something the Liberty could tap into in this series.
I think they can, and this brings me two places. One, it reminds me of the Liberty shifting Stewie onto Rebecca Allen after her big night and just kind of moving the chess pieces around there. Two, very familiar conversation that we've had. This takes me back to Kia. Because throughout this series, you know, going back to the regular season and stuff, the Liberty have been comfortable switching smaller players onto her, recognizing that she's likely not going to get a post-up to abuse the smaller player. And if the action peters out elsewhere, they can scram their way out of it if they want to, and they can kind of flow from there. It may sound wild, but like, it would I be shocked if we see Benaja stay on Chelsea, Sloot on Kelsey Plum, they just put Sabrina on Kia and go Stewie on Jackie Young? That wouldn't surprise me. Now the Aces have counters to play around with that. They want to go double drag and try to, you know, flip some switches and stuff like that. That wouldn't be an adjustment that would surprise me.
I think the key is just to keep Sabrina away from Kelsey Plum.
Hmm. Duly noted.
Just activated, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, yeah, it's a little different. Any closing thoughts, questions on this one before we shift to the NBA side?
No, I think we nailed it. If not, we will see you later.
We sure will. Game 2 on Wednesday, so let's have some fun with some hoops. I guess very quickly, I just note, Jonquel only taking 4 shots in the second half. That feels like a very obvious adjustment that the Liberty can make to continue to keep her involved. Because again, like, if they didn't force like a switch to got a guard on Jonquel, Ace just kind of let that rock. And I do feel like that's a matchup that Jonquel can win. And again, I don't think she had so much success in the first half. For it to turn into 4 shots in the second half is a little drastic. I don't want to completely disregard what the Aces did defensively in the second half, but that's a button that they could press a little bit more. With that being said, we can now move to the Northwest Division. Let's have some fun. We will start in alphabetical order, which means we are starting with the champs, the Denver Nuggets, who went 53-29 last season. They were first in the West. They were 5th in offense, 15th in defense, 6th in net rating. Steve, what excites you the most about the Denver Nuggets heading into the year?
The return of the champions. We get to see another year of Jokic and Jamal Murray. And hopefully this is a healthier version of Jamal Murray. They were very good. More Aaron Gordon, more KCP. We get to see Denver not as the hunter, but someone who's people are going to hunt. What does that look like with a lot of that noise off the table? They've proven their defense can be enough to work for them. They've proven their offense can be very difficult to guard. So now, can you maintain it? But when you have a beautiful basketball team that's shown what they can do, it should be fun to watch that. That's where I'm at with Denver. Where are you?
I think for me, like, I want to see, honestly, I want to see what Jamal Murray looks like post-ring. Like, he's never hurt for confidence in this league. Now that he's, like, officially, quote-unquote, stamped with this ring and the playoff performance and the finals performance in particular that he put on, do we just see, like, a completely different version of Jamal Murray now? Do we get, like, the regular season version of how good this dude is, like, statistically? Because I think for a lot of folks, like, you just kind of miss how good Jamal Murray is because of how good Nikola Jokic is. And because like you don't see Jamal Murray averaging 27, 5, and 7 or something like that, to where it's easy to point to, oh, this guy can do everything offensively. But from a skills perspective, he absolutely can do everything. And we saw in the postseason that skill, that impact, and just the traditional box score numbers to prove, oh, wait, nah, this dude is actually one of the best point guards in the league. So I'm excited to see, again, a fully healthy offseason for him, for one. And two, just what that confidence level is going to look like heading into the year now. Because he's there's nothing else you can say about Jamal Murray at this point. Like, I think it was Calvin Booth saying not too long ago, like, we anticipate paying him the Supermax if he makes All-NBA. I won't be surprised at all if he makes an All-NBA team this year. So I'm excited to see that. And then secondarily, they have so much youth on the squad, which leads into like my biggest question heading into the year for Denver. But they have so many young wings that I'm intrigued by. And with the, you know, Jeff Green not there anymore, Bruce Brown not there anymore, and just the general, these are 82 regular season games for a good team, so we have room to kind of explore and figure out what our bench is going to look like. Hey, man, one or two of these young wings might pop, and I'm excited to see which one it's going to be.
I do think the interesting part about Denver, and like this is paying the cost of winning a championship these days. We see it every time. You have won. Congratulations. Two of your players are now gone.
Yeah.
That were very essential to what kind of made this work. So I don't think they're going to apples to apples be able to replace Bruce Brown. And you kind of lose the luxury that you had of, or you're worried about the non-Jokic minutes. Here's Jeff Green and Aaron Gordon doing things. So you don't have that. But you do have, okay, we know this works. So we know what we need from these players, as opposed to just totally searching. And now it's who's going to emerge and do this consistently versus what do we need?
Right.
Now, I mean, again, we give a salute to DeAndre Jordan. His defense against Phoenix, that drop in the regular season. Oh, we can just play it? That's a joke, by the way. That's a joke. Mm-hmm. But I do think Reggie Jackson with a full year can help. Actually coming back, being integrated, I think he can give them good minutes. I think they like Peyton Watson. I think they like Hunter Tyson. I think they like Zeke Nnaji. Now it's going to be on them to produce the results. Mm-hmm. And you know how this team works. You're going to have to work defensively. You're going to have to work offensively and move the ball. But I think there's a versatility that they have and a potential that they have, even with a Justin Holiday. It's just finding the right pieces.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just quickly bounce off of that. Like, my biggest question for Denver heading into the year, I literally have my notes. Bench consistency, backup big room. That's just kind of it. I know what the starters can do. Like, the other obvious one is just health. Will Jamal Murray stay healthy? Will Michael Porter Jr. stay healthy? Like, we know that. That's a caveat for literally every team. Will their best player stay healthy? But beyond that, okay, where are you getting maybe not the Bruce Brown level impact, but, like, if Christian Brown needs to hit 35% of his threes and play solid defense across three positions, will he do that for all like 71 games that he appears in during the regular season? Or will that only happen in 38? And he's really good in half and the other half is like, oh no, what's going on here? They're ignoring him off the ball, et cetera, et cetera. With the wings, like I've been reading and listening to all these glowing reviews about what Peyton Watson's look like, going back to like summer league and stuff like that. Okay, let's see. And like, not even shade, like a legitimate, hey, let's see. This is exciting. I want to see what this looks like. Because I think if he pops, he's going to be someone that can play and defend multiple positions. He's going to be able to knock down shots. He's going to be able to keep things moving offensively. I think he can be a hand and glove fit for what Denver wants to do on both ends. But I want to see it. And into the big man room, part of the reason they went with Jeff Green and Aaron Gordon is because they didn't get enough consistency from Zeke Nnaji. And so is this another opportunity for him to pop? Remember, they traded for Thomas Bryant last year to help bolster the backup big man room, and that didn't work out either. This is yet another opportunity for Zeke Nnaji in particular. And like, I like what he could be. I think he is a big that can switch better than most. He is someone that can step out and knock down shots from the perimeter. Can he do that consistently enough? Can he hold up enough defensively? And even if he's not switching, can he rebound well enough? And so I think there's a lot of upside for this group. I also wouldn't be surprised if we're looking at, you know, we get to January or something like, hey, who are the Nuggets going to trade for to help bolster this thing? Because we know what they can be in the playoffs, but like right now they're like fourth in the West right now and they're like two games ahead of six or something like that. They need to boost the bench. I wouldn't be surprised if we get there either. I just want to see what it looks like. Who's your X factor or breakout candidate for this group?
Christian Brown for me. I think he showed a lot last year, and there should be more of a runway for him to continue showcasing on both ends. He just fits. Gets after defensively, offensively, good cutting, good driving, good playmaking. He just works for this team. I think that's going to help. Peyton Watson intrigues me, so Peyton Watson question mark, I guess, would be my secondary as far as breakout goes, just because of that versatility. But that's where I'm like, okay, what do you plan on doing with Watson and Hunter Kaisen? What does that look like? What can they contribute? And how are you going to use them? Because here's the thing about Denver. We always talk about they need more, they need more. They always kind of find someone. So Is there something they're not talking about to us?
Mm-hmm. Or is it just, hey, Julian Strother, you're going to play 18 minutes a night. You're going to take 6 threes in those 18 minutes and you're going to shoot well. We're like, who the heck is this guy? Where did he come from? Might just be him. Literally in my notes, Christian Brown, honestly, insert wing here. So we are aligned. Let's see who may pop. Again, if Christian Brown proves that he can knock down shots at a consistent level, like, I think that just, he's going to be firmly in the rotation anyway, I think. But that just further solidifies himself as like one of the better bench players in the league if he can do that, because he has everything else, in my opinion. Lineup you're most excited to see from Denver?
The starting lineup?
Just the best starting lineup.
Was I supposed to be wacky here? Like, I don't.
No. It's what excites you. If it is the starting group, it is the starting group. I think that's fair. They're really freaking good together. So that's fair. I think for me, like, I went off the beaten path because I have so many bench questions. The lineup I'm most excited to see, or I guess more in this case, more curious to see, it's Reggie Jackson, Christian Brown, MPJ, Aaron Gordon, and Zeke Nnaji. If they want to maintain the elements of we have two switchy front court players and do that with the second unit, if we want to keep Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic kind of paired together, this is a chance for MPJ to get more of a unit offensively and let him explore a little bit more. Again, more room for Christian Brown. As you mentioned, if Reggie Jackson is completely implemented in this group and he's able to bounce back from the year he had last year, like, he can give them regular season value. And so I want to see what that kind of staggered second unit looks like for Denver. Any closing thoughts or questions for them?
Did you just say Reggie Jackson?
Yeah.
Okay.
We shall see.
It's a new season. All right. So
a new season indeed. We will now move to the Minnesota Timberwolves, who went 42-40 last year. That was 8th in the West. 23rd in offense, but 10th in defense. They were 18th in net rating with a 0.2 net rating. So right above zero. Steve, what excites you the most about the Minnesota Timberwolves?
The potential. Can they now put all of this together? Now, this is a little bit cheating because Minnesota has played a couple preseason games. Mm-hmm. But it's just, can we figure out how to make Karl Anthony Towns and Rudy Gobert work? Another year of Anthony Edwards, who had a really, really good summer. You have Mike Conley at the start for a full season. We know he has chemistry with Rudy Gobert. We know he can play on and off ball. He definitely helped elevate the Wolves. How much does that impact having that from the start? Jaden McDaniels and his defense. Do we see more offensive growth? So I think there's a lot to be excited about with Minnesota. I do think that Karl Anthony Towns has come out with a lot more purpose this year. And I do want to compliment Minnesota for having more purpose offensively as far as trying to use him in different ways. So we've seen a lot of double drag from them early. And of course, it's preseason, but a lot of double drag, a lot of staggers, using them both together. Karl Anthony Towns has done a better job when he's spaced of looking for gaps, not just to attack when he gets a catch, but also to cut. And that's been very fun to watch. He's been very aggressive on the drive, very, very aggressive on the drive. I do think a key is going to be getting him catches in different spots. I do not say this with disrespect. He does get stuck in a 2K animation when he starts out at the top of the key and he hits the turbo button and it's two dribbles and that's it. And so I again, would just like to see him a little bit more J's, maybe deliver a blow first. Let's work on that. But he's getting there. But I think there's a lot to like about what Minnesota could do potentially. And then the more that you have things that Kat and Rudy Gobert can do together, it helps you stick with two big lineups. So now Naz Reid, who's back, can play. And you can kind of keep it holistic to a degree. And then defensively, do you feel more comfortable about what you're doing? You are aware of what Rudy can do. I think they've shown a couple of different things with Karl-Anthony Towns as far as keeping him back in a drop to keep some consistency, but also, hey, if you need to, go ahead and show, just hedge. But I think they're moving away from just pure at the level, two on the ball, we have to rotate. So I want to see how that works out. But I think there's a lot of upside for Minnesota right now.
Okay. Some glowing words from Minnesota. I'm intrigued. I think for me, first of my notes is very on brand for me. That's fine. The next steps for Jaden McDaniels for me, who I think put together, are you already laughing? Put together an all defense caliber campaign last year. Quietly, or I guess in my opinion, it should have been a little bit louder. Shot 43% from three post all-star break. Usage rate slightly under 18, so still isn't super high, but higher than it was. Looked more comfortable as a driver, quicker decisions being made. If he pops in any capacity offensively, because while he shot well from three, it still wasn't I am garnering a hard closeout as a shooter. Like, that's just going to take more volume and more consistency from him in that regard. But if he legitimizes himself as a good shooter from deep that someone has to pay attention to, that's going to free up more room for the Rudy roles. It's going to free up more room for Cat to operate with. More importantly, for Minnesota looking out, going to free up more room for Anthony Edwards, which obviously he is the beacon of this franchise right now. But I'm excited to see what the offensive growth looks like for Jaden McDaniels. And I think he's also just excited to see what his next extension is going to look like. So I'm sure that man is getting paid. You think about what he does on both ends of the floor, plus the age and the potential curve. He's going to get some money at some point. I'm sure we're going to get a Wolves tweet within the next couple of weeks or so. But very excited to see what Jaden McDaniels is going to look like. Also, Karl-Anthony Towns and Rudy Gobert only played 665 minutes together last year. Plus three in those minutes. But that's very low. And that's regular season plus postseason. So just a healthier version of that duo so we can actually see how well will this work or if it'll work all together. I'm excited to see what that looks like. Biggest question mark you have for Minnesota?
Can they hit the right notes offensively and defensively? And I have the high expectations for the regular season. They have to work to be able to answer the questions to where this works in the playoffs. If teams are going to go smaller, can you play two bigs? Can Karl-Anthony Towns defend some of these fours? You know, we saw it especially last year where teams were like, hey, cool, we're going to make you move. You're going to be spaced and we're going to make you move. Can Rudy maintain the drop? Are they going to give up shots there? Can he defend in space? And then offensively, can you do enough to take the switch button off the table? And I think that's the biggest battle for Karl-Anthony Towns. It's not that he doesn't have talent. Look at what teams are willing to do, like the people they're willing to switch on to him. Even go back to the play-in game. Go back to last year, the playoffs. They're willing to put an Austin Reeves on him. Luka started the game out on him. Mm-hmm. Can you take that off the table? Because you know teams have no fear of switching against Rudy Gobert. And I mean that with no disrespect, but what was it, 2 years ago when they switched Isaiah Thomas onto him and just like, that's fine. Jamal Murray switched on him in the playoffs. If both of those guys become switch people in, you know, top tier games of the playoffs, that's going to limit what your offense is going to be able to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think they have to work to establish their defense and they have to work to get that off the table or at least have a counter. And, you know, I've liked what I've seen from Kat. I think Rudy Gobert's had a couple good seals as far as I'm going to roll. I'm going to look to hit somebody and I'm at least here. But ultimately, that ceiling is going to be lower if they can't answer those questions.
Gotcha. I think that's fair. Quickly on the Cat front, I was looking this up on Second Spectrum. On possessions featuring a pick and roll with Karl-Anthony Towns that gets switched, 0.85 points per possession, which is very low. On pick and rolls featuring Cat that are not switches, so all of them excluding the switches, jumps up to 0.99 points per possession. Like, it's a pretty big gap in between what happens when teams switch against him versus when they don't. To your point, yeah, they need to make sure that Cat just doesn't become an auto switch because that becomes pretty problematic for this offense, which again, ranked 23rd last year. Now Cat missed a bunch of time, et cetera. There are mitigating factors beyond that, but it wasn't super great when those two were on the floor last year either. I think beyond the Cat versus switches thing for me, it's going to be bench shooting. Like, I don't want to super gas it, but like, I do think losing Torian Prince hurts quite a bit. And I think with some of the players that they added, or some of the players that they plan on playing more this year, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, they add Shake Milton to the group, etc. These are guys that can knock down shots, but not guys that bend defenses. You bring Naz Reid back. He's someone that is very willing and capable of knocking down threes above the break, and he can do so better than most bigs. But zooming out, is he someone that generates a whole bunch of gravity? Gets kind of tough. And so that's where I'm like, hey, man, and Kyle Anderson's also going to be coming off the bench, who can knock down shots, but our defense is going to be running him off the line? Absolutely not. And so as you get into some of the staggering, and you have a whole lot of big people on a whole lot of big people on this roster that you can kind of switch against, how do they generate space? And so that's something that I would like to see answered relatively early.
I'm a little surprised. We've done this podcast long enough. I thought a bench unit of Shake Milton, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, Troy Brown Jr., Kyle Anderson, and Naz Reid would have you like doing cartwheels.
I am excited to watch them, but I'm also worried about teams just saying, yeah, we'll switch all that. Or when someone has the ball, like, yeah, we're just going to sink in. Let's see what happens. I don't want them to fall into that loop. Like, individually, like, yes, I do like literally all of those guys. But again, like, I go back to the first round series against Denver. I was like, this is some good defense from Naw. And then on the other end, it's like, oh, they are just not guarding him like that. That's kind of tough. Hey, this is a cool, like, 4 or 5 pick and roll with Kyle Anderson and Rudy Gobert. But, oh, they're just not guarding Kyle. That's kind of tough. And so, again, it's just going to see not just who shoots well. Because, again, it wouldn't surprise me at all if, like, Troy Brown shoots 37% for three, if Shake Milton shoots 37% for three. Who's going to shoot well enough and often enough to shift how defenses guard those guys? And what kind of space do they open up for the others? I think that's going to be the big thing, aside from, again, Cat and Rudy stuff.
I have a question.
Okay.
How important is it for Minnesota to have that type of lineup where maybe the shooting isn't there, but they've got a level of versatility with some of the movement that Minnesota likes? Does that balance it out for you at all? Or is it just, I'm worried about this?
I think it can balance it out. I think that's going to be more of a general how fast do they play, or just what their tempo is going to look like with that second unit. But I am still pretty concerned about what the spacing is going to look like. So I guess we'll just have to see in that regard. Breakout or X Factor for you?
Nickeil Alexander-Walker for me. I'm very intrigued. I think he's been a lot more active defensively. I think offensively, he can provide some shooting, some playmaking, some versatility. I think he gives them lineup versatility if he pops. So that's probably my X factor. Secondarily, Jaden McDaniels' offensive leap, but that's not really a person. It's more of a concept. Mm-hmm. But I think if Jaden takes another leap and becomes, I can knock down shots and drive closeouts, that opens a lot more up for this team. Breakout. It's probably still Naw.
Okay. I am surprised by this answer. Not that it's a bad one, but like, I just knew you were going Rudy. Like, Rudy is who I have as the X factor for this group. Cause he has to get back to like super elite defense, I feel like, first and foremost. Where I think he was just firmly like pretty good defensively. And that's a pretty significant drop off from the DPOY level stuff that we've seen from him in his past. I think he has to firmly establish himself as one of the best, reestablish himself rather, as one of the best drop bigs in basketball. Because I don't think we saw that enough last season. And then offensively, it's pretty obvious. If they switch smaller players onto you, can you punish them with post-ups or on the offensive glass? Because too often, it wasn't just him missing shots or turning the ball over on post-ups. It's him missing, getting his own rebound, and then missing the putback, too. And it's just like, it can't be everything for you offensively. The jokester in me wants to see if he's actually going to take jumpers this year. I would like to have some joy in these games.
So, do you know who doesn't want to see that? Anthony Edwards.
Anthony Edwards, yeah. He is not. He said he will walk off the court. He will walk off the court. But no, like I think Rudy's going to be my X factor for this team. Also, again, he's the face of the biggest trade in Wolves history, arguably. When you think of what all they sent out, he kind of has to pop this year because the contract's going to keep bigger. And it's going to be kind of hard to move on from that. And I think that would lead to some uncomfortable discussions or decisions about the rest of the roster if they have to reconfigure something, because Rudy may not be. No contract is unmovable. Like, that's been proven over and over again. But, like, it'd be pretty difficult to find the kind of pieces they want. If they do feel like this just isn't going to work, I think that would just lead more to, okay, what can we get for Cat to balance this out? And I don't think Minnesota wants to get there. And I'm sure Minnesota fans don't want to hear that either. But they, yeah, they need to bounce. We need, need a bounce back from Rudy Gobert. I can't believe I had to say that. That's interesting.
I mean,
What's next? Keep it. I know where you're going.
We can circle back there.
All right, fair enough. Line up you're most excited to see.
I mean, I would like to see Mike Conley, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels, Karl-Anthony Towns.
Okay. We are not too far off. Like, I went slightly bigger. Anthony Edwards, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, Jaden McDaniels, Kyle Anderson, and Cat. This is a group that only played 2 minutes last year. Give me 100, give me 150. I want to see that it works or see that it doesn't. 2 minutes is not close to being enough to knowing what kind of sample that's going to be. But, like, theoretically, that's a lot of size in the front court. I mean, that's some fun stuff in the front court. That's pretty sizable in the back court as well, once you consider how strong Ant is. Yeah, I think just the defensive trio of Ant when he's locked in, Nickeil Alexander and Jaden McDaniels are probably the best trio that they have. And I think between Ant and Kyle, like, you have enough playmaking, and Cat when he isn't throwing hook passes all over the place. Like, you have enough playmaking to really run some fun stuff with that group. So I want to see it. Any closing thoughts or questions with Minnesota?
No, no. I think they're going to be a fun team to watch.
Speaking of fun teams, let's talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder. They went 40-42 last season. That was 10th in the West, 16th in offense, 13th in defense, 15th in net rating. Steve, what excites you the most about the Oklahoma City Thunder heading into the year?
I'm excited to see what this looks like. I'm excited to see how they handle a level of expectation versus their plan of sorts, their commitment to development. Their standards, I would say. How do they balance that out? This season is going to give them answers one way or the other. I don't think they have all the answers right now. You know, there's a lot of talk about OKC. Hey, they should make a move. They should make a move. I don't think they know which pitch to swing at right now. And so this is part of the buildup for them. And now you really are going to get some answers. Now, the positive is you've built a lot of good things as far as being a program. You have young talent. Now, how good is this? I think there's no doubt OKC believes in what they have. There's no doubt they believe in where they're going. This year, I think we find out how far that takes them. And so for me, it's more just questions. Is the league more ready for us this season? What's it look like with Chet Holmgren now? How much of an impact does he have? How do teams react to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and what he did last year? I believe he's going to get more attention. Is that a plus for you? Does that open things up? Does that make things more difficult for Shai? And does that now make it more difficult for your team? Do Josh Giddey and Jalen Williams have another leap in them? And then you're going to find out flaws in certain scenarios. Is it your shooting? Is it your lineups? Is it your defense? Which has sneakily been good, as you've stated for the last 27 years of this two-year podcast. But that's where I want to know. What exactly, how much good is in here? Because I think they do have length. They have size. They can drive the heck out of the ball. They have talent. Lineup versatility is there. Now you have Chet, so you have a big who can do multiple things. What does the puzzle look like?
So sounds like a lot to be excited about. I don't know. For me, like, it starts with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who firmly cemented himself as one of the 10, 12 best players in the league last year. I'm excited to see what this year is going to look like coming off of the strong FIBA play that he had. Jumper looks a little bit more fluid. Do we see an improvement with the mid-range jumper? Do we see an improvement with the three ball? Do we see more of a willingness to go into pull-up threes now? And what does that open up in pick and roll? The fact that he's going to have or should have a legitimate pick and roll partner with Chet Holmgren, I think, is going to be a lot of fun. And, like, the defensive stuff is going to be pretty obvious with Chet, provided he stays healthy. Very good rim protector. But, like, what does that look like? And then just in general, the guard/wing room. Josh Giddey also had himself one heck of a summer. do we see him continue to bounce off of, you know, continue to grow as a driver? Do we see more improvement with the floater, a little push out in the middle of the paint? What does the three ball look like for him? Jalen Williams, who forced himself into rookie of the year discussions last year. Now, how you feel about those discussions, that is your prerogative, but he forced himself into that conversation with how well he played. We only got to see a little bit of him in summer league, but he seemed vastly overqualified and slightly better. So, like, I'm excited to see what year two for him looks like. Honestly, the answer is just yes with this Thunder team. I'm just excited to see what it looks like with a fuller cast and Chet in the mix. Go ahead.
No, I am for one shot that you were excited to watch the Oklahoma City Thunder play basketball. Whoever could have seen this coming?
I see what's going on here. That's going to be a meme, by the way. Biggest question mark you have for the Thunder?
Well, I think I just asked most of them in my intro there, but I just think, okay, what does it look like balance-wise? If teams are able to gap Josh Giddey and the drives don't hit the same with him, is that an issue? Do we now get to the point where, okay, why is Lu Dort doing this? Not that I'm disrespecting Lu Dort, because I think his defense is very important and I think he's very aggressive offensively. But do teams now say, hey, go ahead and do stuff? Like, how do they deal with game plan defense? How do they deal with more respect? Which is it? That's the biggest one for me.
Can I ask you a free throw adjacent / respectfully messy question?
Sure.
How close is Lou to the Dylan Brooks zone from last year?
Well, based on how y'all talk about basketball players, very, very, very quickly.
What you
the
mean?
The only thing that y'all, Y'ALL.
That's crazy.
All the Thunder have to do is win. And if they win more and they're more important games, then more people will watch and they'll be like, oh my God, why Lu Dort take this shot? He can't do this, da 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 da. And then it'll be a whole discourse and stupid debate. So soon.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that was.
Shouldn't be that way, but I've literally watched y'all talk about basketball just enough to know this is on the horizon. As soon as the Thunder get good, Lu Dort, I'm not a fan. Da-da-da-da-da, whatever.
Okay. Well, we will try to maintain the balanced perspective here at the dunker spot. All ball defense, very important. The drive is also important.
He's good at basketball.
That's true. That is true. You know, you live with some of the stuff to get the other stuff. So. I think for me, my eyes kind of go to Josh Giddey and what the potential leap will be. Like, I am high on him. So, like, I, you know, to be frank, like, I think we're going to see another leap from him, especially off of the summer that he just had. But, like, if he doesn't, if the jumper doesn't progress, if teams are like, all right, fine, take this floater, it doesn't fall, like, what does that mean as the team is, you know, working towards better, wants to be a legitimate, just a playoff team versus a play-in team this year? And then kind of zooming out to the team building aspect, we talked about this a little bit with the Dame conversation before he was eventually moved. And I was like, I don't think OKC actually gets into this hunt. It'll be fun for them to do so because they have the picks and the players to get into the race if they want to. But like with any star trade moving forward, it feels like Josh Giddey would just be the prospect that they could build a deal around. And so I do wonder, again, if he's as good as he was last year, which is still a good young player, does he fall more into the piece that gets us what we need room versus part of the core, if that makes sense? And so, like, ultimately, I feel like that's a good problem to have, especially with OKC being at this stage and not competing for a title right now. But, like, that's kind of the biggest question that I have. And then secondarily, like, just general size questions behind Chet if he's not healthy. This was a Thunder team, as you mentioned, like, they defended well for the personnel that they have. But they also just did not rebound well. They were 28th in defensive rebound rate last year. And as they try to play in higher stakes games more consistently, they're going to need to be able to rebound. And so I want to see, like, who steps up in that regard. Do we just see more from Jalen with the eye in the front court? But again, like, this isn't a very big group in the front court. Across the perimeter, they have just a ton of 6'5", to 6'7", 6'8", dudes. But that also seems to be, you know, 6'8 range is also where it's at in the front court. And it's like, there's only so much you can do as a gang, if that makes sense. So that's kind of where my eyes go. Breakout candidate or X factor for you?
For me, it's Cason Wallace.
Ooh.
That's my breakout candidate. I'm very intrigued by what he looks like in this setting. I thought in the summer he showed a lot on both ends. I thought the defense popped in a similar way that Jalen Williams' effort popped to me last year. Mm-hmm. I think offensively, he's got that kind of blend that the Thunder tend to like as far as being able to shoot the ball and be aggressive in that way. I think that's only going to help them. So I think his development is a plus for Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how many minutes he gets. But I believe he's starting because Shea's out tonight. So I think he's part of the plan. Mm-hmm. Mitic, I hope I pronounced that right. I think this is a good fit for him. So I want to see what he adds to their program. I'm trying to figure out, I think Jalen Williams is established, but if he gets a lot better, I think it gets even trickier with OKC because he's very good, took what the defense gave him. Now does the defense have to pay more attention to him? And with how they've orchestrated things, the driving pops, the effort pops defensively, I think there's some pluses there.
Got you. I think for me, like I just went in on the Josh Giddey thing, so naturally he's an X factor for me. And well, I ain't here too long either, but Chet Holmgren could just change a lot for this Thunder team. Again, barely outside the top 10 of defensive rating last year without a traditional rim protector. You add someone like Chet who has the ground coverage, has the instincts in the drop, has just the length and general shot block ability that he does. And then offensively, someone that can pick, you know, pick and pop or pick and roll and add some diversity to the offense. Like, I think he can really just lift the ceiling of this group. He can lift the floor and the ceiling of this group if he stays healthy. So those are my two. Lineup you're most excited to see.
Obviously, the starting lineup, I think, is going to be very fun. But I would like to see Shea, Cason Wallace, Josh Giddey, Jalen Williams, Chet Holmgren.
Okay. For me, the lineup I am most excited to see, Shea naturally, Isaiah Joe, who, again, one of the best shooters in the league. Glad he carved out a consistent role for this OKC group last year. They needed every bit of it. But Shea, Isaiah Joe, Jalen Williams, the wing, Kenrich Williams, who should be back and healthy, and Chet Holmgren. And I would just point out, 68-minute sample, the Thunder were plus 47 in 68 minutes with Shea, Isaiah Joe, Jalen Williams, and Kenrich on the floor together. Very good quartet. Let's see it. Let's roll it out. No, you weren't getting through a Thunder section without me bringing up Kenrich Williams. The man is good at basketball. Any closing thoughts or questions with the Thunder?
Nah, man.
Bro heard Kenrich and said, nah, I'm done with this topic. That's great. All right, let's move to the Portland Trailblazers. 33-49 last year. That was 13th in the West after the shutdown. 18th in offense, 29th in defense, 26th in net rating. Steve, what excites you the most about the Blazers?
It's a new era. It's a new day. What does this look like? Year one of Scoop. We have DeAndre Ayton staying dominating as much as he can. You have a bench that's going to have Malcolm Brogdon and Robert Williams. Jeremy Grant's still there. Another year of Shaedon Sharpe. There are pieces here. So what is the vision now? Mm-hmm. We've kind of seen them try and have versatility, try and have size, trying to have length. But now there's no Dame. So now what is the offensive approach? What are you running? Who's going to be the table setter? What's the hierarchy? I think there's things there. So I'm excited to see how good this is. How good is what you found going to be? What does Anthony Simons look like in this environment? Mm-hmm. You know, what does DeAndre Ayton look like in this environment? Can you build a defense to make this work? Who's going to be the small forward? But I think for me, I'm just excited to kind of see, okay, what this is now Portland 2.0. Let's see what the reset button is.
I got you. My notes start with real Scoot hours. So safe to say I am excited to see what Scoot Henderson looks like in Portland. Honestly, it's just the young perimeter trio of Scoot, Anthony Simons, and Shaedon Sharpe, which, again, the Blazers shut down some vets towards the end of last season, accumulate the losses, improved the lottery odds, et cetera, et cetera. Shaedon averaged 24-6-4 over his last 10 games and shot 38% from three on over 8 attempts. Like, the man got the ball in his hands and hooped efficiently. Not going to talk about the defense right now. We need to see that continue to step up. But there are some legitimate ball skills here, in addition to the eye-popping athleticism, in addition to the shooting. And so if he's just a starter this year, or if we just see him average more minutes than he did last season, like, I'm excited to see what year two for him is going to look like. Anthony's just one of the best shooters on the planet, period. End of story. Spot ups, off movement, pull ups, it does not matter. He's going to get even more leeway. They got our guy, I guess, Nate Jones has been clamoring for Anthony to play more point guard because of the ball skills that he has. He hasn't gotten to do that consistently playing alongside Dame. I don't know how much more actual point guard usage he gets alongside Scoot, but he is going to have the ball in his hands more. So, like, it wouldn't surprise me, like, with those three on the floor, they're going to have the equivalent of, like, the eighth best offense in the league or something. The defense will probably be bad, but that wouldn't surprise me because that's a lot of offensive firepower and they can all grow together. Your biggest question mark about this Blazers group?
My biggest question mark is you were not, I mean, Boot Scoot and Boogie was right there. Also, I don't remember the same energy for the Dame, CJ, you know, Larry Trent era. It's fine, though. We can talk about it later.
Beautiful gowns.
Wow. Defense, and then rotation. So who is your fifth? Who is your fifth starter? And how are you going to fit all these pieces in? There is more opportunity for usage for, obviously, Scoot is going to create a lot. Anthony Simons, Shaden Sharp, Jeremy Grant, DeAndre Ayton. Can you get everyone enough touches? Can you get the buy-in to get the ball moving? Are you going to be able to unlock things? That's mainly it for me. Can you get the offense to a place where it's moving and you're able to get pressure on teams? Is the ball not going to move? And then defensively, can you get after it enough to make this work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have some pretty big questions about the point of attack. Like, I do not – Anthony has taken steps, but I would say he's still a below-average defender on the perimeter. I think Scoot is going to wind up being a solid defender. I don't know what this is going to look like in year one for him. And again, like, Shaden also just has his things to improve on. It's more so off-ball awareness, in my opinion, but, like, screen navigation can get better for him, so we'll see what that looks like. And just to quickly bounce off of what you said, like, I guess, honestly, between, like, the 2 through 4, like, that's a lot of names that they can play, and just trying to figure out how you feed everyone. Like, they brought Matisse back, and he quietly shot well from three. We had a whole mailbag question about it. Like, hey, he actually shot well from three, post-All-Star break, et cetera. What does that look like? How much playing time are you getting from Matisse? Because, like, he is your defense answer right now among that group, but he's not going to be a higher priority than, like, Anthony or Shaden, or he shouldn't be at the very least. How many minutes will we get from him? I honestly, outside of Scoot, which great pick in my opinion, like, I feel like Portland just nailed their draft in general. How much Chris Murray do we see? I think he's someone that can slide in relatively easily offensively at the very least. To the defense point, like, do we see any Ryan Rupert with all of the length and stuff that he has and the defensive range that he has? Do they give him any kind of shot? What room does he have? So just figuring out the rotation stuff, again, this isn't a team that I would imagine is like trying to get a top 6 seed this year, so it's not a huge problem. But I do want to see how they kind of figure out what the hierarchy is there. Your X factor or breakout candidate for this group?
Before I go there, does DeAndre Ayton and Robert Williams and having centers of that size make you feel any better about the defensive potential?
It can, yeah. Like, I need to see what level of engagement we see from Ayton defensively, and I think it's going to tie into, like, how many offensive touches he gets. And as we talked about, you know, post-trade, like, this does seem like an environment that even if the usage doesn't shift a bunch, he may just feel better, and maybe that just induces more energy, and that opens up some scheme versatility for him. And then Robert Williams, just an electric rim protector, he just has to stay healthy. So it should help, but, like, those are still some questions that those guards have to answer. Just wholesale.
Here we go. I gave you an opportunity to praise Portland's defense for the first time in Dunker Spot history. Was that X Factor?
Yeah.
Shaden Sharp.
Okay.
What does year two look like? If there's going to be more opportunity, obviously more knowledge, you understand the game, a lot of growth made last year. Now, what does it look like if he puts the pedal to the metal? And if he's very good, now I think that ceiling looks a lot different. I think breakout, I guess Shaden Sharp counts for both categories.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like an important Anthony Simons year.
Hmm.
It's not that he's bad, but I think we know he can score. Has he scored enough to where defenses are going to treat him differently? Does this opportunity give him more wiggle room to grow in that area? I mean, get you 20 a night, but can he now blend the scoring and the playmaking and also help elevate this Blazers offense? Mm-hmm.
He did take some steps as a playmaker last year. Like, it felt like he got bigs at the level a little bit more often than he did the year before. He's passing pretty well out of that. Still waiting on more advanced reads from him, just to briefly riff on that. But I like the offensive potential for Anthony. You know, my major questions are on the other end. I don't have to continue to hammer those. But for me, like, I also had Shaden, and I also had DeAndre Ayton, which I just talked about, like, how big the engagement level for Ayton's going to be defensively. Offensively, just seeing what level of exploration he's going to be able to get. Do we see him go back to just the face-up game, period, and seeing how much he's able to grow out of that? But if Ayton hits, like, one, the trade feels better. Two, you just have a really good young center locked in. Two, the trade feels better. Let's flip that order very quickly. But yeah, so those are the two for me right now. Actually, can I ask you a very quick question? How long do you anticipate Jeremy Grant being there?
Because, like, I think it depends. Like, I don't think it's going to be a very quick move. Mm-hmm. I think he's a part of what they're doing right now. I think if they need to pivot, they will. But I don't think this is a, hey, just hang out for a few months. Like, I think they gave him the bag for a reason. Mm-hmm. So I imagine he'll be there.
Got you. Because, like, one, we just haven't talked a lot about Jeremy Grant. He is a good basketball player on both ends of the floor. And I thought, or at least my thought was, once he got that deal as early as he did in free agency, this is very much a we want you here, and also we want you here because we want to continue to build this out around Dame. And obviously that went the other way. And so it's just like, considering, again, the wings forwards that they have that are younger, also just the general direction of the team changing after the Dame trade, like, does that open up stuff for Jeremy to, for a contender to pluck Jeremy Grant or something like that? So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that very quickly. Line up you're most excited to see.
Ooh, I want to go left field here. Are you ready for this?
Yes, because I have two. Hey,
how you feel about size, man?
Oh, this is going to be good. Is this Ayton and Williams together?
Not just Ayton and Williams. Give me Ayton. Give me Williams. Give me Matisse. Give me Shaden Sharp. Give me Jeremy Grant.
Oh, that is a really big group. Good Lord.
Give me the size. No, I mean, I probably would go. See that. I would like to do a three-guard lineup with the Blazers, but I believe their guards are just too small to make that work. It's like, could you do, like, Scoot, Simons, Malcolm Brogdon, Jeremy Grant, and DeAndre Ayton? I'd like to see what that looks like at least once.
Good.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to stick with that one.
Okay. That's not too far off of the first lineup that I had. It's Scoot, Simons, Shaden, Jeremy Grant, and DeAndre Ayton. They get your three young guard/wing prospects out there. You got Jeremy Grant to do some defense things, and also, hey, there's not on the clock, give us something. And then DeAndre in the front court, I think that could be fun. And then, like, hybrid second unit for me, Anthony Simons, Shaden Sharp, Matisse Thybulle, Chris Murray, Robert Williams the third is something that I want to see what it looks like.
Is that you pitching the bench? Oh my gosh. What? Oh, I found another one. Are you ready for this one?
Yeah, what you got?
Give me Brogdon.
Okay.
Give me Matisse. Give me Jeremy Grant. Give me DeAndre Ayton. Give me Scoot.
Okay. Picking up what you're putting down. Any closing Blazer thoughts or questions?
I would keep an eye on this team. Like, I think it's very easy to put them in the lower ranks. I imagine this is going to be a motivated bunch. Mm-hmm. I think Scoot's probably going to want to do well and quote-unquote fill those shoes. Jeremy Grant has a chance for more usage. DeAndre Ayton, we've seen what he is excited and happy to do in this arena. Got a good center rotation. They are my nominee for chip on the shoulder team. Last year I picked Utah, and I mean, I'd just be talking.
Okay. Well, while we're on Utah, let's close it out with Utah. 37-45 last year. That was 12th in the West, but they did quote unquote call off the dogs towards the end of the year. They very firmly in the play-in race until very late. 9th in offense, 23rd in defense, 22nd in net rating, though that was almost neutral. So kind of speaks more to the period than being like bad since they were 22nd in net. What excites you the most about this Utah Jazz group?
Just the versatility, the way that they use their bigs, the lineups that they can create. It's always been fun. I think the youth of this team also intrigues me. I think last year they kind of had that mashup and mix. And as you said, they kind of went a different direction. Now you have some of the younger pieces in position to play more. What does that look like? How do they develop? And then how do you build on what you found last year? Is that sustainable? Is that going to be the formula? Have you hit a different level? I'm intrigued to see where they go.
Okay. I think for me, my excitement starts with Walker Kessler as like just the bona fide starter now versus, you know, early in the year, had some starts sprinkled in. And then January 10th became the full-time starter. And in those 34 games, averaged 12 and 11 with nearly three blocks, which is always fun when a rookie very quickly establishes himself as one of the best defensive players in the league. Like that's what we saw with like Evan Mobley the year before. And Walker Kessler comes right in and he's just one of the best shot blockers and rim protectors in the league. So I want to see how he continues to expand on that. Secondarily, fully healthy Colin Sexton intrigues me. Like very quietly, career high 61.6 true shooter percentage last year. Shot 39% from three, but volume was low. Career high free throw rate as well. Like I remember the Cleveland days where, man, these are a whole bunch of pull-up twos. Why doesn't he take threes, etc.? Came off the injury, came off the bench for most of the year, but got to the rim a ton, got to the line quite a bit for his minute load. He is someone that can get downhill. He's someone that can shoot. Playmaking continues to improve. Again, still not an advanced passer, but certainly big step since the early Cleveland days. Fully, you know, healthy offseason. Point guard room is wide open, which kind of flows into my biggest question for this Utah group. But I want to see Colin Sexton play basketball this year. Like, I want to see what kind of room he has this year. What's your biggest question for Utah this year?
How are you going to use John Collins?
Yeah.
I was very excited, and this is unfair because they have played a preseason game. How are you going to use John Collins? Because Utah, I thought, was a perfect fit. We saw them use Kelly Olynyk, Lauri Markkanen, and Walker Kessler together. So, okay, John Collins is a bigger opportunity. There's more ways you can use him. I felt like he was in the corner a lot. And I had Atlanta Hawks flashbacks. That's no disrespect to anyone involved. But I was like, okay, are you just going to be spaced? Is this the same thing? Please tell me this is not the same thing. That's question number one for me.
Yeah, I just... when you have a talent like John Collins and the cost is Rudy Gay and second round pick, yeah, give me John Collins. I will just try to figure it out. And now to your point, we are just reaching the figure it out portion. And you said, again, one preseason game. That's one of the games that I have not. I saw some of, because Utah Clippers, right? Like I saw some of the third, but like, I haven't watched that in full to like do a full synopsis, whatever. Yeah, I'm curious to see like how they put this together. Because I feel like there's only so much variety that you can do with bigs, period. And then do you add in how much they're doing for Lauri, how much they can do for Kelly, how they want to implement Walker Kessler into things. Also, just some of the younger front court pieces that they drafted. It's just like, okay, how are you using John Collins? Where are you playing him? Are you going to use him as your backup five at all? If so, who are you flanking him with? And frankly, as I look at this Utah group, like they don't have a Trae Young in the guard rotation, which I don't think that's disrespect to anyone. But even beyond like just Trae Young being good at basketball, who's the best passer in the guard room?
Is this Talen Horton-Tucker slander?
It's not, but it's also like that's a pretty big drop off when you think of John Collins' best skill being a roll threat or a slip threat if you want to get more granular with it. But who's feeding him to really unlock him, in addition to can we run him off screens now? Can we do, before even getting into the varied uses that you may want to have with him, who's unlocking the very best thing that he does? So I just bouncing off what you said, like I want to see how they use John Collins as well. And again, like I have the general, who's going to be your point guard? Like, is it going to be Collin? Do they give Talen more of a runway? do we look at what happened in Summer League with Keontae George and say, you know what, actually, let's just let him do it because he seems to be just really good. Let's just let him cook. Is it just going to be more Jordan Clarkson, who was good last year? So I don't want to use that as disrespect, but is he your answer at point? Like, I would like to see him more off ball still, especially since the shooting has continued to grow with him. I just want to see who I just want to see it. I think is where I'm at. Your X factor or breakout candidate or both.
Breakout Keontae George pops. I think the scoring really jumps out. I think the playmaking, he showed a little bit during Summer League as far as if you got attention, getting it out there. So I think it's going to be interesting to see him grow in that area. Ochai Agbaji for me as well.
Yes.
I've been very big on him. I think it was one of the two players I contributed to that one draft episode we did.
Is it him and Jalen Williams?
Yep, pretty much. Pretty much. But I think there's some potential there. I like the ability to shoot. I think having a summer where it wasn't quite Desmond Bane, but hey, do other stuff. Mm-hmm. Here's the ball. Let's see what you can do with that. I think he is someone who intrigues me. I think there's a lot of potential. I think this is, you know, it kind of bleeds into kind of one of my questions. Okay, when does it go from these guards to these guards? And what's that transition period going to be? Mm-hmm. But I think the play of those two are going to help Utah down the line.
Got you. I also had Keontae George and Colin Sexton on my list. So we are aligned there. Lineup you are most intrigued by.
Oh, and then one thing before I get to my lineup, I do want to see another year of Lauri Markkanen because I don't want that to be disregarded. Like, he was very, very good last year. And yeah. His assistant that really fits him. So I want to make sure I give him his just due and salute him. Lineup I'm most intrigued to see. Let's just get all the bigs. Just give me all the bigs. Just give me Jordan Clarkson with John Collins and Lauri Markkanen and Kelly Olynyk and Walker Kessler. Just give me all the bigs.
Oh, God.
Oh, too much? Okay, I'll give you a real one.
Hey, question. is Kelly the best passer in that lineup?
All right.
I'm asking.
Jordan Clarkson, Ochai Agbaji, Lauri Markkanen, Kelly Olynyk, Walker Kessler.
Okay. Naturally, I had a lineup that just did not play together last year, but I'm curious to see it nonetheless. Give me Chris Dunn. Give me Colin Sexton. Give me Ochai Agbaji. Give me Lauri. Give me Walker Kessler. Steve has hands on face because I brought up Chris Dunn, who hooped last year, by the way.
No, the reason why I'm laughing is because I was sitting in my head before you started the lineup and I was already setting up in my head, wow, we made it through a jazz segment without you mentioning Chris Dunn. And as soon as that thought landed in my brain, you immediately said Chris Dunn. And so that made me laugh.
Hey, you do a podcast with someone long enough, but again, remains nasty at the point of attack defensively. Offensively, he had the ball in his hands a lot more second half of the year. Show some good things on the ball, earn himself a contract. So I want to see more Chris Dunn. And also, like, Walker Kessler naturally going to be just the starter this year, barring an injury or something like that. If they want to improve from 23rd defensively, like, playing Chris Dunn consistently is going to be one way to help you do that. Like, him and Walker together on the floor, that could get pretty fun defensively. So I want to see him. Any closing thoughts or questions on Utah?
Nah.
I guess since I think you briefly mentioned them, but how much of the post All-Star break Talen Horton Tucker stuff was real? I'm curious about. That man ran a lot of ball screens post All-Star break. And like him just trying to mix in the drives, which he's always been able to get downhill. But also the jumper, which when it hits, he has the freaking 40 pieces. And when they don't, hey, man, what are you doing? It's interesting. So we'll see how Talen's able to build off of that as well. Last thing on the Northwest Division, we've got to close it out with some rankings. Steve, how do you see the division going this year?
Denver, Minnesota, Oklahoma City, Portland, Utah.
Ah, well, we have the exact same order, so I guess we don't have to hang too long there. Who are your top 10 players in the division?
Nikola Jokic, Anthony Edwards, Jamal Murray, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Karl-Anthony Towns, Lauri Markkanen, DeAndre Ayton, Jeremy Grant, Jalen Williams. Mike Conley.
Mike, you found a way to get Mike Conley back in here. I feel you. Okay. I have thoughts, but we're late in the pod, so we'll save it for a watch party. Top 10 for me: Nikola Jokic, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Anthony Edwards, Jamal Murray, Lauri Markkanen, Karl-Anthony Towns, Aaron Gordon, Rudy Gobert, Jeremy Grant, Anfernee Simons is my top 10.
But you didn't even have Jamal Murray on your list last year.
Correct. I'm so glad you said that.
No, I don't want to hear it. No, I don't want to hear you say, well, he was hurt, and then I couldn't put him on because he was hurt. But I said, if he comes back healthy, obviously he's one of the top 10. I don't want to hear it, bucko.
That is hit literally what I said.
Hit the horns.
That's nasty word from you, because that is literally what I said on the pod. I want to see him do it, and he did it, and now he is back in the top 10.
Yes, you said it, so you can say this. I'm not dumb. Hit the horns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join us in the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. We are having a lot of fun in there. We're getting into madness with some of the TikToks that our community members are sharing for us to watch. Jane Brain, you must pay for your crimes. Why are we making macaroni in the air fryer? Why are we doing this? What's going on? We don't have to do that. Anyway, if you want to join our online Dunker Spot watch parties where we are watching preseason hoops on the NBA side, we are still watching the WNBA finals. As that continues to go on, next game is on Wednesday, so tap in. The link to the room should be hyperlinked in your podcast description. If so, click on the link, enter your information. It is free, no shenanigans. If not, copy and paste the link into your browser. Once again, it is free, no shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Hey, why Tyrese Halliburton ask Bailey then?